It's The Takeaway for December 30th. I'm Sean Carlson in for Tanzina Vega. Today on the podcast, the trade war with China may be winding down, but farmers across the country are still struggling.
A lot of my neighbors, quite frankly, that are milking conventionally have quit. They've just decided to quit to stop the bleeding.
Also on the show, reports indicate it will take more than 250 years to close the gender pay gap in the U.S. and around the world.
So when we put that in plain terms, you know, for Black and Latino women, at least for my daughter, she won't see pay equity or gender pay equity in her lifetime, and neither will her daughter.
And as 2019 wraps up, we're hearing from you on your least favorite movies of the year.
Joker with Joaquin Phoenix.
Scary stories to tell in the dark.
The Lighthouse with Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson. It did not make any sense at all.
A lot of stories coming at you. Let's get going. So earlier this month, the U.S. and China announced a Phase 1 trade deal designed to halt the 18-month-long trade war between the world's two largest economies. The full details of the plan have not been made public just yet, but officials say China has agreed to buy more agricultural products from the U.S., while the United States will scale back some tariffs on China. The partial trade deal comes at a time when farmers across the U.S. are struggling to stay afloat. Farm bankruptcies are up 24% from last year. That's the highest level the farming industry has seen since 2011. And farm debt is expected to reach a record high $416 billion in 2019. That's according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We asked small farmers to tell us about the economic challenges they faced in 2019.
My name is Amy, and I'm a small farmer, very small farmer, in Ferndale, Washington. We have 5 acres. We raise dairy goats, few pigs, chickens, turkeys. The hardest economic part for us has been the cost of feed and the cost of fencing. 5 acres is what we have, and that's a small farm, but it's a lot of money in fencing.
We want to thank Amy for that call and say that she's not the only one. Across the U.S., dairy farming has been hit especially hard, in part due to global overproduction and the decline in American milk consumption. But retaliatory tariffs on dairy from Mexico and China have also taken a toll. The Trump administration has given billions of dollars to farmers affected by the trade war, though some Democratic senators have criticized that aid package, arguing it benefits large-scale farming operations over small ones. In fact, a study by the Environmental Working Group found that 60% of federal aid that came into New York State went to the top 10% of farmers. Joining us now is Liz Bodden. She's a dairy farmer in upstate New York, and she's co-president of the Northeast Organic Dairy Producers Alliance. Liz, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So can you just give us a broad overview here of what your experience has been like as a dairy farmer over the last few years?
Oh, the last few years have been pretty rocky for dairy farmers of all stripes. We're fortunate because we've been in the organic market for almost 20 years now, and that does give or had given a much more stable pay price over the years, but that's taken a big hit in the last couple of years as well. So I've seen a lot of my neighbors go out of business. It's a kind of a sad, empty feeling out here in the country where, at least where I am, there's not a lot of other types of farms other than dairy because of our land base, basically the best land. And there's lots of good land in New York State. It's just not right here. The best land is usually row crops, and then more marginal land is usually used for livestock farming because you're grazing those fields and growing grass for hay. And that's what the land where I live is most suited for. So if it isn't dairy, it's just kind of sitting there idle.
When did you start noticing a change in dairy farming?
Well, to be honest, there's been a gradual change. You know, I'm 62 years old, you know, so I remember growing up, and I didn't grow up on a farm, but I grew up in an area where there were farms. So friends of mine, you know, their families made a living milking 35 or 45 cows in 1970, where they made a living for the family, sent the kids to college, and had a small family farm, and that economy worked. And we've seen a gradual decline through the farm crisis in the 80s and all that. We've seen that basically that the price that at least dairy farmers are paid for their milk has really not increased with the cost of everything else. So the economy has just moved on past. And so it's forced farmers to get bigger, to produce more, to make the money, to pay the bills. That leads to the overproduction. So it's this huge, horrible cycle.
You know, at the risk of prying here, can you tell us how you've managed to keep your business afloat? Has it remained profitable despite all of this?
Well, I guess as a farmer, you know, you make it work because you're determined to make it work. My husband used to joke about he doesn't know how many jobs, you know, his wife is going to have to get in town to make this farm work. But to be fair, since my son was born, I've worked on the farm all the time, and it hasn't been necessarily lucrative all the time. The organic market, quite frankly, was what allowed us to stay small this long because of that price differential. It made the difference of paying your bills or not paying your bills.
And of course, that's your situation. But you mentioned some of your neighbors. How have they been dealing with this?
A lot of my neighbors, quite frankly, that are milking conventionally have quit. They've just decided to quit to stop the bleeding. They could no longer financially, either they were maxed out that they couldn't borrow any more money to keep the farm going, or they just really, they were close to retirement anyways and didn't see the reason to keep going because they were losing more money. So for some of the people, it was a pretty heartbreaking thing where they quit, and it's sad to see, you know, in a small farm, people get attached to their animals. So the worst thing for a farmer is the day that the cows go, you know, little kids crying because their calves, all their animals had names. It's a pretty heartbreaking thing.
We mentioned the aid package that the Trump administration is carrying out in order to help farmers going through hard times like this. Have you seen any of those funds? And what's the impact been from where you're at?
I don't think any farmer would like a check from the government over simply being paid a fair price for their milk. That's really what it boils down to. And it, you know, thank you for politicians who are paying attention that this is a difficult time for farmers. But the government can't simply write a check to cover months of indebtedness. And so that's the problem. There's the program that farmers can sign up for, and it's based on what the price of milk that month is versus the price of feedstuffs. And there's a big, long mathematical calculation as to whether you get money or not. But when you get that, at least a farm our size, it was a couple hundred dollars. So thank you. That's nice. But it's a trip to the grocery store, not paying three payments on that combine that you're late on. You know, like it's not enough money to get people out of the bad situation that they're in.
Given everything that we've been talking about, are you optimistic about the future of dairy farming and just farming in general?
Well, I have to be optimistic. I guess if you wake up every day and set your feet on the floor and decide it's going to be a good day, then it probably will be. I have a son who wants to take over this business, and he has never wanted to do anything else in his life other than farm from the time he was just a little guy. So we're trying to make that happen. We've just built a new barn for the cows that is going to be way more comfortable and make them a whole lot happier. And we're just moving into that situation, but we are having to milk more cows to make the same money and yeah. Figure out a way to do that, to do the extra work for that, for the same amount of money. So that's kind of a little crazy, I suppose.
Well, Liz, we want to congratulate you on the new barn. Liz Bodden is a dairy farmer and co-president of the Northeast Organic Dairy Producers Alliance. Liz, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now we want to take a step back and look at the big picture for farmers across the country. Joining us now is John Newton. He's the chief economist for the American Farm Bureau Federation. Hey, John, welcome to The Takeaway.
I appreciate the opportunity.
So we were talking earlier about this report that you put out in October about farm bankruptcies. Can you give us a little bit of context about how bad farm bankruptcies were in 2019 compared to previous years?
Well, sure. And I think it's important to put into perspective, you know, farm income has fallen by about 30% from the record high farm income environment we saw in 2013 and 14. So we've been monitoring a number of farm financial indicators, and farm bankruptcies being one of them. And what we found is over the previous 12 months, farm bankruptcies across the U.S. had increased about 24%. In some parts of the country, they were at decade-high levels. We had 580 Chapter 12 filings over the previous 12-month period. That's an acceleration from what we had seen in the past, but still well below the highs that we saw in the last farm financial crisis of the 80s.
The next natural question here is why?
Well, I think, as Liz pointed out, many farmers have burned through equity. We've had low commodity prices across all of agriculture for 4 or 5, and in some cases 6 years. Milk prices have been low. Corn prices have fallen by about 50%. Soybean prices fell by about 50%, and then now face the brunt of the trade war. So a lot of farmers have burned through a lot of their capital and find themselves in a pretty tough financial situation.
And going back to what Liz was talking about earlier, and this is a constant tug of war, it feels like, in American history here in terms of small farms versus bigger ones. Are small farms getting hit harder right now than larger scale farms?
Well, I think a lot of farms are getting hit hard, regardless of size. When you lose one of your top export markets, or when you face headwinds in Canada and Mexico from retaliatory tariffs on steel and aluminum in early 2018, it hits all of agriculture. Pretty tough, whether you're small or large.
So when we break it down by state here, it looks like Wisconsin has the largest number of bankruptcy filings. Are those mostly dairy farms that have been going bankrupt there?
Well, we don't have the information to tell you what type of farm it is that's going bankrupt. That's going to be something that's in the case file. But given the number of dairy farms that are in Wisconsin, in New York, one has to believe that a lot of those bankruptcies are likely in the dairy business.
Why has dairy been hit particularly hard?
Well, it really goes back to, the cure for high prices. This is an old ag saying. The cure for high prices is high prices.
And in right.
2014, milk prices were record high. Farmers around the country added cows. You saw tremendous growth in both conventional and organic milk production, not only here in the United States, but around the world. And so that global oversupply led to depressed milk prices. And it's taken us a long time to work through those inventories, both domestically and abroad, and that's why we've seen low milk prices. The trade war didn't help, and the African swine fever in China didn't help either, because the Chinese bought a lot of whey products to feed the world's largest hog population. So you've had a number of factors that have combined to really roil the dairy industry.
You mentioned the trade war with China, and as we mentioned, we've reached a phase one trade deal with China to change things for U.S. farmers. Should we expect that to improve the situation in coming months for farmers?
Well, one would think. I think you look across the world, we've got a deal with Japan that gets us on a level playing field with all the other trading partners that move forward with TPP. United States pulled out of that. You look at USMCA. We hope the Senate will get that over the finish line in the new year. And then the phase one deal with China. So you have your 3-0 on the trade front, and that should help. I mean, we need to export agricultural products. 95% of the world's population lives outside the United States, and U.S. farmers are some of the best in the world at caring for animals, raising crops, and we need access to those markets.
This might be a lot to chew in the last 30 seconds here, but if you can give us a quick answer. The Trump administration, as we mentioned, has allocated billions of dollars in aid to help farmers. Do you think it's done enough?
I've not talked to a single farmer across the country, and I travel quite a bit, that would rather have aid instead of trade. Farmers want to knock on doors around the world and sell products around the world. The Trump administration, the aid has certainly helped. Folks meet their immediate financial needs, but it's not made anyone whole. And that's why these export markets are so critical for the future of U.S. ag.
John Newton is the chief economist for the American Farm Bureau Federation. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be part of the discussion.
The World Economic Forum just released its annual Gender Pay Gap Index report. And get this, this is not a typo. The report says it's going to take another 257 years to close the gender pay gap across the world. We just want to give you a moment to think about that number. 257 years. And by the way, it's almost 50 years longer than what was predicted by the forum just last year. The index has examined 153 countries since 2006. Iceland continues to top the list as the most gender-equal country, whereas the U.S. dropped by 2 ranks this year, landing at number 53. And in the U.S., the wage gap is even more extreme for women of color. Black women make 21% less than white women, and Latina women make 31% less than white women. But even though the 2020 report says it's going to take us longer, a lot longer, to reach full equity, we are seeing some progress. Joining us now to break down the report for us is Nicole Mason. She's president and CEO of the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Hey, Nicole, thanks for coming on the show.
Glad to be here and really having this important conversation.
Well, as we mentioned, the Gender Gap Index, it launched in 2006. Can you tell us about some major trends you've seen since then?
We continue to see unequal pay for equal work. Is still an issue for women in the U.S., and men continue to out-earn women in most occupations, and that continues to be true. And just thinking about that stat that you gave a few moments ago about the length of time it'll take to close the gap, it's because change has been so slow and incremental, and so not much has changed in terms of economic parity for men and women since the last index. One of the trends that we are seeing is the role of automation in terms of pay equity and closing the gender wage gap. Women are more likely to be impacted by automation. So let's say in 1999, women's labor force participation was at its peak at around 60%. In 2024, it's estimated that labor force participation among women will be around 55%. And that's due in part to the role of automation.
What other major changes have there been in the global workforce in terms of this pay gap in the last decade or so, aside from automation?
So women continue, in terms of economic participation, which is the, you know, where we see the biggest gap at the index, women continue to earn less and are not in senior level positions in terms of corporations or in jobs. So that's a trend that has persisted from 2006 until now. So women are not in positions, economic positions of power, and that's really hurting, you know, women and I would say societies, you know, across the globe.
So what kind of power do women currently hold in the economic sphere?
So when I think about the power that women hold in the economic sphere, I think about our consumer and purchasing power. But again, when we put that in conversation with lower wages, yes, women make up a majority amount of consumers globally, but they actually have far less to spend. And so when we think about what creates a booming economy, we measure that in part by consumer confidence. But women, because of the lack of earnings or pay parity, are still less confident in terms of spending.
And as we mentioned at the top here, drilling down into the numbers for the United States specifically, these disparities in terms of the gender pay gap, they're more pronounced for women of color. Have those numbers moved at all in recent years?
Actually, they have not. In fact, when we put into context, so for Black women, in terms of achieving pay equity in the U.S., it's going to take about 150 years. For Latina women, it's going to take more than 200 years. So when we put that in plain terms, you know, for Black and Latina women, at least for my daughter, she won't see pay equity or gender pay equity in her lifetime, and neither will her daughter. And so we're talking about two generations out. And we think globally that is also the case.
Geographically speaking, are there parts of the country where we see differences in this?
Yeah, absolutely. So in states like Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana, so in the South, the pay gap is significantly higher than in other states. And so, for example, in California and New York, there is greater gender pay equity between men and women. For example, in California and New York, there's higher educational attainment levels for women. There might be more progressive policies, public policies to support women in the labor force, and women are more likely to hold managerial or senior level positions as well.
Can we look at other countries, say, where maybe they're making strides on this as a template for how to make progress here in the U.S.?
I think we can and we should. If we look at what's happening in, you know, Iceland and Norway and Sweden, we can really think outside of the box about what it'll take to achieve gender pay equity and gender parity, you know, not only in the United States, but globally. When I think about what those countries are doing right, I do think it's about empowering women economically and also politically, and making sure that they are able to participate in the economy in ways that are meaningful to them. I think having progressive public policies related to childcare and parental leave are also critically important. As you know, in the United States, we don't have strong parental policies and protections for women. And so when women leave the workforce or the labor force to have a child, we see her earnings decrease significantly.
And we mentioned at the top, too, that this closing of the gender pay gap, it's slowing down. And not in a small way either. We're talking about a 50-year difference from last year. What should we take from that?
We should take that we need to be really proactive about this. And this is really urgent, because the reason why 50 years was added was because between 2006 and 2020, there was very small incremental gains, and it was really at a slow pace. And so if we continue at that same pace, it will take an additional 50 years. The good news is that we can be really proactive and really lean into this issue and begin to accelerate policies and other shifts that will be necessary to close this gap.
Nicole Mason is the president and CEO of the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Nicole, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
The Takeaway is supported by Zola. Zola makes wedding planning easier and less stressful with wedding websites, registry, invites, and a handy guest list manager all in one place. Start your free wedding website on Zola so guests can find all your wedding info in one place. Their registry is easy to use and flexible, so guests can get you gifts you actually want. Sign up at zola.com/takeaway today to get your free personalized paper sample. Then use code SAVE50 to get 50% off save the date orders of $10 or more. That's zola.com/takeaway and promo code SAVE50.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, the furor on college campuses over the war in Gaza.
Students have tried to have dialogue over and negotiate differences in how they see the world, even as they respond to tragedies and crimes overseas.
Students and faculty from Harvard University on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Ring out the old year, ring in the new, ring a ding ding.
Merry New Year!
It was at her New Year's party that I found out how she felt about me.
I'm sorry, Harry. I know it's New Year's Eve. I know you're feeling lonely, but you just can't show up here, tell me you love me, and expect that to make everything all right.
Three, two, one.
Hi, everybody. Happy New Year. This is The Takeaway. I'm WNYC's Sean Carlson in for Tanzina Vega. We cannot end 2019 without looking back at the year in movies. And 2019 saw some of the biggest franchises of all time draw to a close, at least temporarily.
What are you doing there, 3PO?
Taking one last look, sir, at my friends.
Avengers!
And this year, Hollywood also spent hundreds of millions of dollars on special effects, everything from de-aging Robert De Niro to straight up turning humans into cats.
Because Jellicles can, and Jellicles do.
Jellicles do, and Jellicles can.
Jellicles can, and Jellicles do.
I have to say, I've never started a segment to cats before. It's a new one for me. With us now in the studio to talk about some overlooked highs and a few lows in 2019 movies is Rafer Guzman. He's film critic at Newsday and for us here at The Takeaway. Hey, Rafer.
Hey, Sean.
Okay, so first off, the good news. Tell us about a few things you liked this year that went under the radar.
Well, one of the ones I'd like to talk about is a documentary, a music documentary called Everybody's Everything, about Lil Peep, a rapper that I don't think many of us knew until he died at a very young age, 21, in 2017. And he made headlines in the trade publications and Rolling Stone and such and Pitchfork. And people, I think, were scratching their head going, who was this guy? He was a SoundCloud rapper. He was a guy who had built this grassroots network just by putting his tracks up on SoundCloud and was in the process of becoming a writer. rising star when he died of an opioid overdose at the age of 21.
Here's some context for the movie. Here's Lil Peep's mom speaking about her son in the movie.
He's trying to do this work, and Emma kind of brings him out of it, and he's making progress and getting better at it and meeting people online and doing the stuff and on his own, and probably so much of it unbeknownst to me, except for the fact that every night I heard him singing. You know, he worked while I slept, but I heard him. And so this was made me happy because he was doing something that he enjoyed and was committed to.
And as you mentioned, Lil Peep had a major online following, but a very short career. How does the documentary tell the story?
Well, one way it does that is, you know, we're talking about a generation here that films absolutely everything. So what you have is a lot of this fan footage and a lot of footage from one of his video directors who was accompanying him for a lot of his career on tour. And it's just fascinating to see this immediate footage of this kid who is, you know, got no record label, got no real management team, no PR. And he's over in Russia playing to sold out crowds of 3,000 kids, some of whom met him on the plane, like found out that when his plane was arriving and went to see him. And you really do begin to get this sense that he wasn't just this kind of underground phenomenon. He really might have been the next huge thing.
So next up, let's move on to Burn Your Maps. It stars Jacob Tremblay. He's a child actor, and people might know him from the movie Room that came out. And he plays a suburban American kid who thinks he's a Mongolian goat herder born in the wrong place.
Hello, my name is Wes, and I'm here today to represent the wandering nomads of Mongolia.
What did he say?
These are Sindak and Altai, my goats. My people weren't just Mongolian. We were shepherds.
I think it's pretty fair to say that it's a wild concept for a movie. What worked about it for you?
Well, you know, I saw this at the Hamptons Film Festival. It's almost 5 years ago now, and I was really charmed by it. You know, you've got Jacob Tremblay. Vera Farmiga plays his mom, so you've got this great cast. And Tremblay was just fresh off this all his praise for The Room, the movie. And, you know, the idea that you've got this kid who he's got an identity problem, right? He's got an identity issue here. It's not sexuality. It's not gender. It's this oddball thing. He thoroughly believes he's a Mongolian goat herder. He walks around the neighborhood with little stuffed goats he's made, goes to school in traditional garb. And the question becomes for the mom, how far is she going to go to support this kid and help him be the thing that he wants to be, as outlandish as it may seem to her? And it struck me as this really great, non-threatening, almost non-topical in a good way, way to wrap your head around this issue of identity and what you as a parent, you know, what you're going to do for your child. And I thought it was really charming and wonderful. I don't know why it never got a release. I don't know what the backstory is there, but it really languished for years and years. It only came out this year. Again, played a very small release in theaters, but it is on demand. You can rent it, and it was one of my favorite films of 5 years ago. And I think it still holds up, and it's just a lovely little movie.
Okay, Rafer, let's get down to brass tacks here. You mentioned a few underseen movies of the year, but I think it's fair to say that not everything that came out this year was really worth watching. This kills me because I wanted it to be good. But if we're talking about the worst movies of the year, we kind of have to talk about Cats, right?
We do have to talk about Cats. You're one of the few people that wanted to see it, I guess.
I still do. I haven't seen it yet.
I think you should be prepared for a hallucinatory, strangely sexualized, uncanny valley musical with people who are sort of digitally coated in fur, slinking around. A lot of Broadway, a lot of singing, a lot of jazz hands in this movie. and I guess, Sean, if that's going to float your boat, then, you know,
great. I love jazz hands.
Great for you. You may be one of the few people that will come out, you know, trumpeting this film. It's just such a bizarre and strange film. And the reviews have just been abysmal. And I have to say, I give it 1.5 stars out of 4.
Wow.
And I think that was actually one of the kinder reviews that it got.
Wow. We have a couple moments here, so we want to go to another movie you weren't a fan of. It was Rambo Last Blood. It was the final installment in Sylvester Stallone's Rambo franchise. And you said this movie is, quote, we're quoting you, truly bizarre. Why is it so bad? Why was it so bad?
Well, I know that we all expect Rambo films to be violent, but this film really just went over the top. It actually has almost literally nothing to offer except violence. I think the finale of the film 20 minutes worth of just nonstop carnage. There are people whose heads are being trisected. Minor spoiler, he threatens to rip a man's heart out and in the end actually does. I just think this film just really went just completely over the top. It's this insane finale to the Rambo series, and I don't mean that in a good way.
All right, real quick, as we end here, is a palate cleanser for you. What are you looking forward to in 2020?
There are a few things I'm looking forward to. I'm looking forward to No Time to Die, supposedly the last Bond film to star Daniel Craig, who I've loved as Bond, and apparently he's hated being in the role, but I've been thinking he's great. I'm really looking forward to Wonder Woman 1984, if for no other reason than it has New Order's Blue Monday as the theme song. That's guaranteed to get a good review from me anytime. And also Dune, Denis Villeneuve.
Yes.
Redoing David Lynch's Dune. And that's going to be something to see one way or another. Who knows? But I'm looking forward to that.
Rafer Guzman is film critic at Newsday and here at The Takeaway. Thanks so much, Rafer.
Thank you.
And that is our show for today. I'm Sean Carlson. I'm from WNYC. I'm in today and tomorrow for Tanzina Vega. It has been great talking with you today. Thank you so much for listening. This is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.